Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, March 11th, 2015. Hillary's email news conference raises even more questions. Like, do you know how to do the Clinton?
Well, come on, everybody, get head into the spin. Now that he's been in for however long it's been. Grin a good old grin, tuck in your second chin. And everybody do the Clinton. Come on and slide over to the middle.
Over to the middle.
Straighten up and step light.
Up and step light.
Lean it to the left a little.
Just a little.
To the left a little.
Now lean a lot to the right.
Lean a lot to the right. That's my pal Roy Zimmerman. Back in the 1990s, he was the leader of the Four Men, and that was their tune, Do the Clinton. And that was the first thing that came to mind last night when I tuned in and caught portions of Hillary Clinton's news conference that she held in New York. And she wanted to talk about other things, but the media scrum there was demanding answers, and she took questions. But she didn't really answer many of the questions. And her central kind of casual explanation for her private email server, instead of following the rules like everybody else and using a government email server, was that she didn't want to carry two devices. Now, I don't know about you, but I have a fancy phone, and I have numerous email accounts. And I can access all of my email accounts and my Facebook page and other interactive websites from my phone, from a single device. I don't need to carry two. And so that explanation falls flat, just right out of her lips. And then when you even turn the sound down and just look at Hillary's demeanor, it brings back these ugly flashbacks from the 90s, when she was our first lady and she was dodging the Vincent Foster issue. She was dodging the Webb Hubble issue, the Rose Law Firm documents that suddenly appeared in the executive part of the mansion. Then, of course, we had Whitewater. We had her, remarkable achievements as a stock market investor, the fact that she served on the board of directors of Walmart. Hillary Clinton's demeanor is that of a corporate attorney. And she's as good at parsing language and spinning things up as her husband. But she didn't handle the press conference very well. And I have a list here of the 8 questions that were put to her and the way that she responded to them. So one of the questions was, why did she use a personal account? Well, she said, I thought using one device would be simpler, and obviously it hasn't worked out that way. So that's her mini mea culpa. Then, was her email account ever searched in response to Freedom of Information Act or congressional oversight requests? Now, my pet theory here is that the reason she maintained a private email address was to try to put a layer of protection between her and future FOIA requests. So she didn't actually answer that question. But State Department officials have said her account has not been searched between the time she left office in 2013 and December of last year, when she turned over 50,000 pages of emails to the State Department. Next question, did anyone at State or the White House tell Hillary that she was permitted to use a personal email account for government work? Well, again, she didn't answer that question directly. She had some talking points that she referred to, and at that point she said, first, the laws and regulations in effect when I was Secretary of State allowed me to use my email for work. That is undisputed. Then she talked about how the Federal Records Act was amended while she was serving. But her failure to, respond directly to the question about whether she got any advice on this and anybody told her yes or no, again, raises more questions. Did she have classified information on her personal email account? I did not email any classified material to anyone on my email. There is no classified material. Now, that's pretty definitive. That is an answer. But is it credible? A Secretary of State never received a classified email? Well, there are some ways of explaining it. She's always surrounded by staffers who maybe carry devices that have better encryption or part of secured systems. But it is hard to believe that she never, ever, ever in 4 years sent or received a classified email. I mean, WikiLeaks released a lot of emails that were at least sensitive, if not classified. And I'm sure if you go through those, you might find some that contradict Mrs. Clinton's statement. The other thing that I'll point out is that, you know, if she sent an email to 10 people, there are 10 people whose government email servers should have retained a copy of that email. Now, tracking them down can be extremely difficult, but we can reverse engineer this, and at some point, somebody might surface and say, hey, I've got an email that came from Hillary's private account, and it's about important things, and it wasn't turned over to the State Department. That is highly possible. And that means that this whole episode could go on for months. It could be, you know, a real albatross for Clinton in her efforts to run for president. Now, polls show that the flapover email and the revelation that foreign governments donated to the Clinton Foundation in violation of pledges from Bill and Hillary have not really shifted. She's still at roughly 45% positive, 35% negative. And those negatives were hardened, not only by her presentation, but by the echo chamber on the right. They're having a field day with this, reminding people of the lowlights of the Clinton administration. Because while the nation did well, and many people have fond memories of Bill Clinton as president, it was one scandal after another, and not all of them were simply concoctions from the right-wing effort to bring Bill Clinton down. He supplied Monica Lewinsky, the girls in Arkansas, the attempts to cover all that up. And I just cringe at the thought of another 4 or 8 years of a Clinton White House with that same kind of crap. And I could put up with that if I thought Hillary Clinton were determined to do good things for the American people and reverse some of the awful things that have happened in the last two presidencies. But I have no confidence that she would do that. I think she would make most of those things worse. So this is something that will keep on giving. And as you know, I really don't offer comfort to those who will simply attack Mrs. Clinton for partisan gain. But these raise serious issues about her temperament and about her ability to be a commander-in-chief and to serve without having these kinds of controversies surface on a regular basis. Now, I am still deeply outraged at the letter that was signed by 47 Republican senators. I think one or two more have now added their names. The letter that was sent to the Ayatollah and the leadership in Iran, undermining the President of the United States, offering a childish civics lesson that was inaccurate to the Iranians, who dismissed it for what it is. And you have to keep asking, why would 47, 48 members of the United States Senate take a step that is so provocative, that so undermines our system of government, and that could be used against them at some point in the future? It's often that real check, the idea that if you set a bad precedent that the other party will use it against you later, that often keeps Washington on better behavior. Now, I couldn't call it good behavior, but better behavior. Well, today I've learned, and I want to credit a blogger named Eli Clifton, who publishes at loblog.com. And back in November, just before the election in 2014, he noted that Senator Tom Cotton, who was a congressman at the time and was trying to move up into the Senate, challenging Mark Pryor, a Democrat from Arkansas, in the final week of the campaign, an independent expenditure from what I believe is a dark or black group, meaning that they don't expose, they don't report their donors. Bill Kristol had a political action committee called Emergency Committee for Israel. They dumped just shy of $1 million into TV attack ads that called out Mark Pryor because he didn't want to debate Tom Cotton over foreign policy issues where Cotton is a hothead radical extremist. And I don't know the particulars of the debate or not to debate question. But the insertion of nearly $1 million in late money in attack ads from the Emergency Committee for Israel is something that Tom Cotton might remember. He might say, yeah, Bill Kristol was responsible for helping me win this Senate seat. Bill Kristol, famously editor or editor-in-chief of the Murdoch-funded Weekly Standard, sets the talking points for the right wing and for Fox News every week, or they try to. Bill Kristol, famously part of the Project for a New American Century that brought us the mess in the Middle East we have today, perhaps 9/11. Bill Kristol, the guy who has been thoroughly discredited on so many fronts, including his support for the invasion of Iraq and his shrill commentary about the weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist. And so this clearly connects important dots. It's the corruption of our campaign finance system that permitted Bill Kristol to dump $1 million and make the difference in defeating Mark Pryor in Arkansas. And it brings us this hawkish Tom Cotton, who is, in my view, representing the nation of Israel, not the United States, in this scurrilous, treasonous letter that he wrote and got almost all of his Republican colleagues to sign. This is a new low point in American governance. And as you heard me say yesterday, I think this is a really dark moment. And I can't just let it slide as, you know, politics, partisanship, the latest way of trying to bring down Obama. This is a very serious violation of the separation of powers, constitutional rule, and there's a law that goes way back to before 1800 that makes it a crime for somebody like Tom Cotton to undermine the president by communicating with a foreign government. And while this is a little bit of a stretch argument, it's only a bit of a stretch, I heard Senator Angus King, he's an independent from Maine, and he was on with Rachel Maddow last night, and he compared it to the Cuban Missile Crisis. He said President Obama is trying to defuse, the potential for Iran to develop a bomb the way Kennedy was trying to avoid a nuclear attack from Russia via Cuba. Now, I don't think that we're in that stage of a crisis with Iran, but the other parallels, I think, hold. The war on leakers continues from the Obama administration, and now it's reached a juncture that will force the president to choose secrecy over prosecuting a leaker. And when you think about the recent cases of Jeffrey Sterling, the CIA officer who was convicted based on metadata, and the government declassified information, including about a Russian who was tasked with Operation Merlin to deliver phony nuclear plant plans to the Iranians. That Russian was permitted to testify at Jeffrey Sterling's trial. But now, in the trial of retired Marine General James Cartwright, who was accused of leaking to a New York Times reporter about a different classified operation intended to hobble Iran's nuclear enrichment capability, Well, it's reached a point where they're saying we may drop these charges because it could really infuriate Israel if we have to expose the details of this program, which I believe is called Olympic Games. Now, while there's a whole set of issues here about leaking and prosecuting of leakers, the double standard of Petraeus versus Cartwright in this case, what this exposes is the long-running effort by the United States to use covert operations that amount to military attacks on Iran. And Iran has been enduring this for 10 years now. And so I think it just, you know, lays bare the true intention of the United States, and that we are so deep in cahoots with Israel that we have lost our independence. And I think this is a real crisis for the United States, because the Cotton Letter, as I said, advances the interests of Israel over those of the United States. That is treason. That's an impeachable offense. And I'd like to hear more outrage. If you feel it, email me and let me know. Go on Facebook, Peter B. Collins Show. Say you like me and we'll be in touch there. Call your members of Congress and the United States Senate. Because if we let this stand, these radical Republicans will only do more to harm our country and to put us on a path to new wars in the Middle East. That's what this is really about. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Emery Safak and Ira Scott just renewed their annual subscriptions. Thank you both. Gary Washington, Christopher Welsh, Cameron Troxell, they are monthly subscribers. I'd like you to join their ranks. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the link under my picture that says sign up. Next page, you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever is best for you and your budget. Our best deal and the screaming deal is the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers from absolutely anywhere earn a copy of the, my bonus gift is a copy of the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest, which is called Empire of Chaos. And I was really tickled because when I sent the gift card for the Pepe Escobar book to a recent new subscriber, Kathy from Canada, she flashed back and said, oh, I've already got it. Now that I like to hear. Because I think Pepe is special, and I hope you'll read his book whether you get it as a gift from me or not. Well, you may have heard late last week in the Friday news dump something we had been tipped off to. The CIA announced a reorganization. And John Brennan is planning to abandon the agency's current structure that keeps spies and analysts separate. Instead, CIA officers will be assigned to 10 new mission centers focused on terrorism, weapons proliferation, the Middle East, and other areas. And Brennan is also emphasizing cyber surveillance and warfare, which, of course, duplicates other arms of the federal government. And in the show file for today's podcast, I have linked to an important critique of John Brennan's plan. It comes from a group of former intelligence officers who call themselves the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And you know that our friend Ray McGovern is a founder of that group. John Kiriakou, the CIA officer who just got out of jail and who is the subject of our recent in-depth interview, he signed the letter. Also, Colleen Rowley, Peter Van Buren, Kirk Wiebe from the NSA, Lawrence Wilkerson, former chief of staff for Colin Powell, and Colonel Ann Wright. So I'll ask you to read it yourself, but I want to point out that these veterans of our government, and in particular the intelligence agencies, are very clear that they don't want to see analysts and spies working side by side. because the analysts need to be free to produce intelligence without fear of being compromised or politicized. And that's the big fear. They cite what happened before the invasion of Iraq when it says, our analyst's vaunted ethos of speaking unvarnished truth to power was corrupted by Director George Tenet and Deputy Director John McLaughlin, who outdid themselves in carrying out the instructions of President Bush and Vice President Cheney. The new ethos boiled down to this. If the president wants to paint Iraq as a strategic threat, it is our job to come up with the, quote, evidence. And they also point out that even the guy who interviewed the so-called curveball who told us about the phony mobile weapons labs in Iraq, with the report of the interview he filed, let's keep in mind the fact that this war is going to happen regardless of what curveball said or didn't say, and that the powers that be, capitalized, probably aren't terribly interested in whether curveball knows what he's talking about. However, in the interest of truth, we owe somebody a sentence or two of warning if you honestly have reservations. So these veterans, right? The problem with the Brennan restructuring is that it does the opposite. It puts the politicization on steroids. Placing intelligence analysts and operations officers together fosters a quite different kind of atmosphere, the kind that increases the likelihood of what Truman called the most important thing to guard against, leading the president into unwise decisions. They also point out that they're willing to volunteer to help the president restructure the CIA, and that they would prefer to see themselves involved as retired and former professionals than people like Michael Morell, the former CIA deputy director, and the aforementioned John McLaughlin. Now, I somehow don't think the president will take them up on their offer. I'm pleased to see two things in this news account by the Associated Press from a couple of days ago. Soldiers from the African nations of Chad and Niger opened the largest international push to defeat the Boko Haram group in Nigeria, and they have launched this offensive with soldiers and vehicles. There are about 8,750 troops in this African Union task force. And this is the right model. Boko Haram is not a threat to the United States. And despite this recent bullshit that they've pledged allegiance to the Islamic State, we have no business putting our troops in any way against Boko Haram. And I say the same about Libya. We cannot afford any further mission creep. And if you listen regularly, you've heard me express great skepticism about these new alliances between Libyans like Belhaj and the Islamic State, Boko Haram and the Islamic State. And here's an interesting reaction from a spokesman for the Nigerian Armed Forces. He said, Boko Haram's announcement that it is affiliating to the Islamic State is an act of desperation and comes at a time when Boko Haram is suffering heavy losses at the hands of the Nigerian Armed Forces and its regional partners. Now, I don't know that it's suffering heavy losses. I don't know how much spin is coming from this military spokesman. But I think it's important for us to hear this as an act of desperation, because our media plays it as an act of something that we should get under the table and be afraid of, like Boko Haram is going to be knocking on your front door in the next couple of days. And that's the kind of fear-mongering and hysteria that is driving the continued expansion of our war footing and national surveillance state in this country. Other troop deployments, there are new war games starting next week in Eastern Europe. The Pentagon is sending 3,000 American soldiers from the 3rd Infantry Division to get down with the soldiers from Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And this, of course, is just another effort to intimidate Putin. You may have heard a couple of recent stories that in Florida, state workers, including those who work for the Environmental Protection Agency, or whatever it's called in the Sunshine State, have been told they're not permitted to use the term climate change. Governor Rick Scott went public yesterday and dodged the question. But it's pretty clear that there was a directive and that people in Florida must operate in some sort of denial. And is that dumb or dumber compared to this? In China last week, a documentary was posted online, and the documentary is called Under the Dome. And it is a somewhat sanitized depiction of the massive air pollution that plagues China's big cities. And this is hardly a secret. I mean, all you have to do is look outside, right, if you live in China? But the Chinese government decided that this film was dangerous for the people of China to see, and so they removed it. And to me, it makes about as much sense as Florida telling its state workers that they can't say climate change. 4 years ago today, a 9.0 magnitude earthquake off the coast of northeastern Japan triggered a tsunami, and what was followed was the meltdown of three nuclear reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant. What have we learned? Well, the sorry answer is not much. While Japan did take all of its reactors offline for a while, many have resumed operation. And we know that radioactive water is still flowing into the sea at Fukushima. And we're going to see, over the next 20 or 30 years, I believe, a lot of illness and early death caused by the exposure to radiation and the secondary exposure from the food supply and other ways of transmission. And what have we learned here in the United States? Have there been any changes in our procedures of how we store spent fuel? Have we examined the nuclear reactors, for example, here in California on fault lines? Well, we only have one remaining facility left open, the twin plant at Diablo Canyon. It's operated by the rogue utility Pacific Gas and Electric that can't find its gas lines. And recently, the San Francisco Chronicle, in a front-page story, did a great job exposing, and I've linked to this story by David Perlman, the fact that PG&E played fast and loose with the division of regulation. All right? The Public Utility Commission of California regulates everything about PG&E's operations except the nuclear plants, which are under the federal government's purview at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And so, in a pattern that is scary because it's the same thing that led to the shutdown of the other nuclear reactors in California further south at San Onofre. And that was when they swapped out the steam generation system for a new one. And what we've learned here is that PG&E did similar things at Diablo Canyon, only they didn't get approval and they didn't begin testing until very late in the process, which appears to be a violation of the rules. And the State Public Utilities Commission says, well, that's not our fault, that's the federal government. The federal government has been warned by a whistleblower of the risks of continued operation, both at San Onofre and at Diablo Canyon. And so, 4 years after Fukushima, here in California, we are exposed just like we were 4 years ago. And we have spent fuel rods at both San Onofre and Diablo Canyon that are risk in an earthquake and could be targets of terrorists. And we have not done diddly about it. And we're not planning to. Ah, the human condition, ain't it swell? Meanwhile, scientists warn that the next big one will come sooner than later here in California. The probability of an 8 magnitude or larger has increased from the 4.7% estimated in 2008 to 7% now. And you may live in an area where there are blizzards or floods or tornadoes, and you live with that risk of extreme weather or these kinds of acts of goddess. And so we don't get alarmed by hearing this in California, but when you link the predictions that the odds are increasing of a big one, and we haven't addressed the nuclear facilities that are on known earthquake fault lines, what the hell are we doing? It's astounding. In Sacramento yesterday, members of the state Senate grilled regulators from Dogger, that's the Department of blah, 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 oil, gas, and geothermal resources, and it has recently shut down fracking sites where the frackers were injecting their wastewater into the ground, and it was at risk of poisoning nearby aquifers that people use for irrigation and for drinking water. And so I want to credit Fran Pavley, a state senator who chairs the Natural Resources and Water Committees. She's been a real staunch advocate of regulation, if not banning, of fracking in California. So she asked some tough questions, and they trotted out the new director of this agency called Dogger. His name is Stephen Bolin. And he said, yeah, you know, we've shut down some wells, and we're trying to watch this, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then my old buddy John Laird, he was a regular on our radio show for a couple of years. He's now the Natural Resources Secretary, and he's going to bat for this new guy, Bolin, saying, give him some time. We're fortunate that he goes to work every day. Oh, come on, John. That doesn't sway me, Mr. Laird. And finally today, there's an interesting Democrat-on-Democrat battle in Washington, D.C. And here, I will end my criticism, at least temporarily, of Barbara Boxer, the senator from California who's announced she's not running for re-election in 16, and who I think has largely checked out. But not on this issue. There is a long-term effort to rewrite the safety regulations regarding chemicals used in the United States. That seems like a worthwhile task. And the leader of the charge here is a Democrat from New Mexico, Senator Tom Udall. Udall had a pretty good environmental record. But many in the Senate are stunned to see that he has helped the chemical industry write new regulations in a way that protects profits more than public health. Barbara Boxer. I've been around the Senate for a long time, but I've never seen before so much heavy-handed, big-spending lobbying on any issue. To me, it looks like the chemical industry itself is writing this bill. Andy Igrecias, National Campaign Director for Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families, was a little more pointed. Senator Udall's strong support for the legislation, in spite of its remaining flaws, has emboldened the chemical industry to take a more aggressive approach in Congress and to try to disregard the critique of health experts and state governments. So let's follow the money. Millions of dollars in campaign contributions have been distributed among political counts of lawmakers involved in the debate, including Mr. Udall. First elected to the House in 98, Mr. Udall had never before received a contribution from the Chemistry Council. But he got his share of $4 million that they passed out during the 2014 election cycle. And he's cozied up to David Vitter, the hooker-happy senator from Louisiana, who's always happy to do the bidding of oil and gas and chemicals. You just wonder if he drinks formaldehyde for breakfast. That's my news and comment for today. Thanks for listening all the way to the bitter end. And be sure to share this podcast with a friend or just somebody. Thanks.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.